Hello and welcome to the History of the Germans, episode 139, the end of the Interregnum. On October 1, 1273, seven princes elected a new king of the Romans. Their choice was a momentous one that set European history further down its path from a universal empire to separate kingdoms and principalities. The Pope had demanded that they come to a unanimous decision so that the empire could again participate in a crusade to stop the remains of the Kingdom of Jerusalem to be swept away for good. So, why did they choose a modest count from what is now northern Switzerland, and not any of the kings, dukes and princes who had been vying for the job and who could count on support from Naples, Rome, Prague and Paris, is what we will look into in this episode, the first of our new season, from the Interregnum to the Golden Bull, the Holy Roman Empire, 1250 to 1273. But before we start, let me run through the usual spiel about the history of the Germans being advertising free. It matters. I mean, I guess you've seen the recent news about Google being fined $2.6 billion for market abuse as they pushed customers towards their own shopping platform. This used to be such an elegant machine providing super fast, uncluttered access to the information one wanted. Now, it's like a shopping mall where you have to squeeze past shrieking billboards to find the little independent bookshop in the far corner. Now, since I am short a few billion to spend on fines, I rely on patrons and on one-time supporters who can sign up on patreon.com/historyofthegermans and historyofthegermans.com/support. And thanks so much to Michael P., Christian N., Sarah R., Steve M., and Geweinstein who've already signed up. On December 13, 1250, in Castel Fiorentino, near the small town of Torre Maggiore in the northern part of his beloved Puglia, the Emperor Frederick II, the Stupor Mundi, the wonder of the world, breathed his last. The official cause of death was dysentery, but at the time of death, he had been exhausted from decades of conflict with the Lombard cities, rebellious Sicilian nobles, crusaders in the Holy Land, and above all, the papacy. Whilst not defeated, his position was precarious. He had lost the crucial Battle of Parma and, with it, his war chest. Most of his friends and advisers, who had been by his side since he first set out to Germany to gain his imperial crown at the age of 16, were now dead, some by his own paranoia. His death marked not just the end of the era of the Hohenstaufen as a major European dynasty, but also the end of the High Medieval Empire, that had begun with the coronation of Otto the Great in 962. What followed was a century of chaos and convulsions until a new political structure settles in. The Holy Roman Empire, with its electors, its prince bishops, its free imperial cities and its diets and courts, as set out in the Golden Bull of 1356. Oh, that is how the story is commonly told, but as we all know, history does not tip on the pin of a single event. Many of the structural pillars of the Holy Roman Empire date back long before the death of Frederick II, and the ideal of a universal emperor, crowned by the Pope in Rome, continued for several centuries after the light of the Stupor Mundi was extinguished. The death of the last of the Hohenstaufen created two separate sequences of events. One of those were the various attempts of the descendants of Frederick II to hold on to and then regain the Kingdom of Sicily. We covered this in episode 91, Hohenstaufen Epilogue, which is one of the most epic stories in German medieval history, but one that had limited repercussions for the narrative we want to follow here. What we'll focus on now is what happened north of the Alps. In 1245, Pope Innocent IV had excommunicated and deposed Frederick II. And in the wake of that decision, some of the German princes had elected anti-kings. First Heinrich Raspe, the Landgraf of Thuringia, and once he had died, William, Count of Holland. These anti-kings stood against Conrad IV, the son of Frederick II, who had been elected King of the Romans way back in 1237, but had never been crowned. And this civil war ended when Conrad IV decided to seek his fortunes in Sicily in 1251, where he then promptly died in 1254. William of Holland was therefore king at least from 1251 to the day in the winter of 1256, when his horse broke through the ice of a Phrygian lake and his enemies clubbed him to death and concealed his body under the foundations of a house, not to be found for 26 years. William of Holland had two successors, in the loosest meaning of the word. One was Alfonso X, the Wise of Castile, a thoroughly well-educated man with some Hohenstaufen blood, who took the crown proposed by the cities of Pisa and Marseille for reasons even his biographers still cannot figure out quite why. Alfonso never travelled north and remained very much a footnote in the history of the empire. At exactly the same time, some of the electors raised Richard of Cornwall, the brother of King Henry III of England, to be the future emperor. Richard was a bit more proactive than Alfonso, and he travelled to Aachen to be crowned king and then visited the empire in subsequent three times before he became so embroiled in English politics his already modest role in German politics vanished completely. Now, here's the thing. None of these kings had much impact. They were absentee landlords who had taken the title to pursue narrow personal objectives. It was more vanity than a sincere ambition to take on the mantle of a universal emperor defending Christianity against its foes. And even more importantly, they were either unable or unwilling to assume their role in the emerging constitution of the realm as the provider of peace and justice. The Mainzer Landfrieden that formalized the relationship between the princes and the emperor and had established rules for conflict resolution had been agreed upon in 1235. And under these rules the emperor had precious little left of the regalia, the fundamental expressions of medieval sovereignty, which included the right to raise taxes, demand tolls, administer justice, mint coins, found cities, build castles and so on and so on. All that had been given over to the imperial princes. So rather than being a monarch who could call upon all free men of the empire to go to war on his behalf, the emperor was more of an arbiter between the diverging interests of the princes. He had to resolve differences by offering compromises that parties could agree upon. And if one of the parties rejected the compromise, the resolution was to be found by force of arms. All the emperor could do at that point was to set the rules for feuding, demanding a 3-day cooling-off period and putting limits to the level of violence. For instance, the parties were prohibited from burning down castles, houses and barns and should protect widows and orphans. It was apparently okay to produce widows and orphans, just not harm them beyond massacring their husbands and fathers. Combatants who breached these limitations could be subjected to the imperial ban. An imperial ban strips a person of all their rights, namely the right to property and even to his or her own life. A person under the ban was vogelfrei, which translates literally as free as a bird but has a very different meaning. Like a wild bird that belongs to no one, anyone can trap and kill it. Or more precisely, could do that at the time, since this was before the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds was established in 1889. Now this level of imperial power is indeed a long way away from the crowned figure on the frontispiece of Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan that carried the quote from the Book of Job, "There is no power on earth to be compared to him." But despite the narrowness of the imperial mandate, the absence of an effective king of the Romans during the period from 1245 to 1273 did have a major impact. Sure, during the time of the Hohenstaufen and even the previous dynasty, the Salians, emperors had been absent for extended periods of time. But they usually left behind some form of regency council or a caretaker to perform the duties to maintain peace and justice. And the emperor had influence far beyond their former rights due to two things: their personal prestige and the resources coming from the combination of their family possessions and the imperial lands and estates. When it comes to prestige, Frederick II and his grandfather Frederick Barbarossa were hard to beat. Impressive personalities both, able to display imperial grandeur through elaborate displays combined with a military prowess, made their voices heard. It's almost important to remember that the medieval political system was built on personal relationships, not on the monopoly of power of the state. Hence a ruler who can impress his vassals has a huge room to maneuver, even if his formal powers are limited. On the flip side, a ruler like William of Holland, who ever so often had to remind his subjects that he was appointed by the Pope, quickly finds himself isolated and unable to drive policy. As Theodore Roosevelt quipped many centuries later, effective politics means to speak softly and carry a big stick. And in the case of the empress in the High Middle Ages, that big stick were the financial and military resources they commanded directly. The Hohenstaufen had accumulated, well, quite a lot of those sticks. There had been the Dukes of Swabia and hence had large swathes of land in what is now Alsace, the Palatinate and Württemberg. They had taken over the wealth lands in Swabia that were once an almost a duchy in its own right. They had taken possession of the Salian inheritance that had stretched along the Main River and then even further north into the Harz Mountains and included the silver mines of Goslar. By the imperial rule, they controlled parts of Franconia, including the rapidly expanding city of Nuremberg. And then, south of the Alps, Frederick II possessed many a castle, some on the back of the inheritance of the Countess Matilda of Tuscany, some thanks to his son-in-law Ezzelino da Romano's conquests, and then, most importantly, there was the fantastically rich Kingdom of Sicily. Few, if any, princes could ignore an imperial order backed up by so much wealth and so much power. Which gets us to the period from 1245 to 1273. None of the kings and anti-kings had enough personal standing or wealth or power to tell the princes what to do. Some, like Richard of Cornwall, tried to bring their weight as great military leaders and the wealthiest men in England to bear, but he rarely stayed long enough to follow through with his decisions. The conflict resolution process collapsed and imperial bans, if issued at all, were widely ignored. The traditional view is that the empire descended into chaos during this period. But modern historians like the great Peter H. Wilson dispute this and calls it Habsburg propaganda. Now, when I look at what we have seen so far, some of the fiercest feuds were taking place during this period, such as the conflict between the Landgraf of Meissen, Albrecht the Degenerate, and his sons, namely Friedrich der Gebissene, Frederick the Bitten. We also have the rapid expansion of King Ottokar II into Austria, Styria, Friul, and Salzburg, most of which on the back of cold hard steel rather than marriage contracts. But then, feuds and illicit acquisition of lands wasn't anything new, and the days of Henry VI and Frederick II had seen similar rough play. These large feuds of the previous century had taken place in the north, where imperial power was already much weaker than it was in Swabia and Franconia. And what was new, and what brought about contemporary fears of the end of days, was that this kind of violence had now engulfed the south as well. One particular menace is now one of Germany's most popular tourist attractions, the castles along the Rhine. Many of them, like Rheinfeld, Sunek and Reichenstein, had been built by actual robber barons who harassed trade along the river. Given the vital importance of the Rhine as a conveyor belt of goods from the south to the north, including supplying thirsty Englishmen with copious quantities of white wine, the cities along the river tried to bring the situation under control. In 1254, led by the cities of Mainz and Worms, the Rhenish League was formed. The purpose was to keep the trading channel open, smoke out the barons and protect the merchants. The League quickly attracted all the other major cities on the Rhine, Cologne, Oppenheim, Bingen, Speyer, Strasbourg and Basel. They established a fleet of armored ships and besieged Rheinfels. But they failed militarily and by 1257, the League dissolved and the Rhine trade kept suffering. The other main event was the dismemberment of the Hohenstaufen and the imperial possessions. Once Conrad IV had disappeared down south in 1251, local lords began nibbling at the edges, and when he died in 1254, the contest became ever more intense. And then when the last Hohenstaufen Conradine was executed in Naples in 1268, the final feeding frenzy set in. Some of these properties had been imperial fiefs, others had been the private property of the Hohenstaufen family, but all of them were up for grabs. Imperial princes and lesser lords occupied castles and towns, waving dubious charters and double-handed swords. Within just a few years, all of it was redistributed. Some may have believed they took it for safekeeping should a real emperor finally appear, Some, like the Landgraf of Thuringia, claimed to be the true heir of the House of Hohenstaufen, but many just took it for themselves. The Regnum Teutonicum was not the only kingdom that was in trouble in the second half of the 13th century. The Kingdom of Jerusalem was on its last leg. The city of Jerusalem that Frederick II had regained for the Crusaders was lost and had been sacked in 1244. A crusade led by Saint Louis into Egypt ended in another unmitigated catastrophe. The Mamluks of Egypt had now taken over Syria, and the Crusaders were again pushed back to a long strip of land along the coast. Baybars, the new Sultan of Egypt, picked off the great strongholds, the Krak de Chevalier of the Hospitallers, and Montfort of the Teutonic Knights in 1270. In 1272, another crusading effort fizzled out, leaving Acre as the very last outpost in the Holy Land. Now, this impending collapse of the Crusader states did occupy most of Europe, but nobody more than the Pope. As papal policy saw it, only a concerted effort of the whole of Western Christendom could turn things around. Experience of the preceding three decades had shown that efforts by just the French and the English weren't enough. What was needed was a major contribution from the Empire. These considerations weren't just purely political and military. Mystics and holy men had been predicting for a century or more that only an emperor would be able to conquer Jerusalem and initiate the thousand years of bliss, whilst the fall of the empire would bring about the collapse of the world. The current king of the Romans, and hence emperor-in-waiting Richard of Cornwall, could not lead the imperial forces to victory in the Holy Land, in part because he was stuck with baronial insurrections and Simon de Montfort's push for a proper parliament in England, but more crucially because he had died on April 2, 1272. Therefore, despite all the misgivings about overbearing emperors, Pope Gregory X demanded that the next king of the Romans should be elected unanimously and should be someone who could lead a crusade. And the man to make this happen was Werner von Epstein, the Archbishop of Mainz. Now, Werner's first question that needed answering was, what does unanimous mean? In the early days of the empire, all elections had been unanimous. Not because everyone agreed, but because all those who did not agree left the election diet and had to be convinced, aka bribed, one by one as the new emperor made his progress across his new realm. And that model began to fall apart with the election of Lothar III in 1125, when the Hohenstaufen brothers stormed out and went to war with the newly elected emperor. And after that, we had a whole string of contested elections where frustrated contenders claimed the election to be invalid on the grounds that not enough or not the right people had been at the election diet. So, who were the right people to elect a king of the Romans and future emperor? When things kicked off in 919 at the election of Henry the Fowler, the idea was that the king was to be elected by the Stem Duchies, i.e. by the Swabians, the Bavarians, the Saxons and the Franconians. These duchies were to be represented by their dukes and senior lords, which made sense when there were dukes for each of the duchies. But as the duchies fragmented, Franconia into lots and lots of little princes, Swabia into Swabia, Zeringen and the Welfish lands, Saxony into Saxony, Westphalia and Brunswick, and Bavaria into, again, Bavaria, Austria and Andechs-Meranien. And that system therefore had to be abandoned. In 1152, at Barbarossa's election, the general view was still that all lords, ecclesiastic and secular, were allowed to participate. But that then narrowed down rapidly. At Frederick II's election in 1196, counts were excluded, and in 1198, the abbots. Participation still fluctuated. In 1208, 1212 and 1220 elections were large gatherings, whilst those of 1211, 1237, 1246 and 1247 were much smaller events. At Conrad IV's election, the last one that had been universally recognized as valid, only 11 electors were present. These were the archbishops of Mainz, Trier and Salzburg, the bishops of Bamberg, Regensburg, Freising and Passau, and then amongst the secular lords, the Count Palatinate on the Rhine, the King of Bohemia, the Landgrave of Thuringia and the Duke of Carinthia. That election was described as unanimous, even though some important imperial princes, like the Dukes of Saxony, Zähringen and Andechs-Meranien, the Archbishop of Cologne, and the Markgrafs of Meissen and Brandenburg, had not attended. So, this does not help. What we do know, though, is that in 1273, when this momentous election happened, it was broadly acknowledged that there were 7 electors. But nobody has yet found any constitutional document that sets out when and why this was decided, nor a logic that explains who was in and who was out. The first legal text that states the election rights of the 7 electors, the Schwabenspiegel of 1273, unhelpfully claims that it had always been thus, ever since Charlemagne had decreed it so. Now, this is a conundrum that has baffled medievalists for centuries now, and I'm afraid there is still no consensus. There's several competing theories. The first one is the arch-offices theory. And that theory says that the electors are those who hold the great offices of state. The 3 arch-chancellors of Germany, Italy and Burgundy, which are the archbishops of Mainz, Cologne and Trier. Then the Grand Marshal, which was the Duke of Saxony. The High Steward, who was the Count Palatinate on the Rhine. The High Chamberlain, the Margrave of Brandenburg. And the Grand Cupbearer, the King of Bohemia. Now that sounds sensible. Princes who take a major role in managing the empire should also be in charge of selecting the new emperor. The problem with that theory is that it just shifts the debate. The great offices of state for the secular princes come about around the same time as the role of the electors is established. So, it still remains unclear why it was 7 and why these 7. Then we have the canon law theory, which says that the legal framework of the electors was modeled on the College of Cardinals, who had the exclusive right to elect the Pope since the 11th century. That too makes sense and explains why the number of electors was narrowed down. But again, it fails to explain why it was 7 and why these 7. Eike von Repgow in his Sachsenspiegel had stated that there were 6 electors as early as 1237, but then again, nobody knows where he got that one from. Then there are recent elaborate studies were trying to prove that the underlying principle was that the 7 electors are the direct descendants of the Ottonian family through the female line. Now I do not want to offend anyone, but given the analysis identifies 3,400 descendants of the Ottonians alive in 1273, I am profoundly at a loss how this narrows down in any meaningful way. Now, call me a cynic. But if I had been in the position of Archbishop Werner of Mainz and had been under strict instructions by my boss in Rome to organize an election that results in giving the empire a viable monarch, I would go and make sure that I get all the most powerful people in the empire into a room and then make them agree. And as it happened, nature had helped narrowing down the list of powerful princely families in the empire. The Babenberger Dukes of Austria, the Zähringer, the Dukes of Meranien and the Ludolfinger Landgrafs of Thuringia had all died out. Which meant that, if we go through the major clans, there is first and foremost the King of Bohemia, Ottokar II, the by far richest and most powerful of the imperial princes. Well, he definitely deserves a seat. Then we have the Wittelsbachs, who hold 2 major principalities, the Duchy of Bavaria and the Palatinate. But at least one of them should be on the list. Then there is the House of Anhalt, who were Dukes of Saxony and Margraves of Brandenburg, so no question, they should be there. Now, after that we get into more difficult territory. The House of Wettin that had inherited the Landgraviate of Thuringia on top of the Margraviate of Meissen was in the middle of a feud. And then Frederick the Bitten was the grandson of Emperor Frederick II, which would be good enough reason for the papal authority to want him kept out. Then there's the House of Welf, the Dukes of Brunswick, the descendants of Henry the Lion. Well, there was squabbling too, and then, for reasons I cannot quite get, NFI. To represent the church, the archbishops of Mainz, Cologne and Trier were materially richer than Hamburg and Magdeburg. Only Salzburg could compete, but that was outmaneuvered by the other 3. There we have it. 7 votes are needed for a unanimous vote. Now, let's go to the runners and riders, which is what made the election of 1273 one of those rare events that could indeed have put European history on a very different path. Now, the first one to put his hat into the ring was King Alfonso X of Castile. In fact, while he had been in the ring all this time since 1257, since he had already been elected at the same time as Richard of Cornwall. But he hadn't done anything about it. So he wrote to the Pope asking for his endorsement. And that was immediately rebuffed. Pope Gregory X knew that Alfonso had no backing in Germany whatsoever, plus he was another Hohenstaufen descendant in the female line, which made him suspect. So Alfonso X is out. The next one bringing his weight to bear was King Ottokar II of Bohemia. Ottokar II commanded the resources not just of Bohemia, with its rich silver mines and fertile lands. He also had taken over the duchies of Austria, Styria and Carinthia, had put one of his followers on the seat of the Archbishopric of Salzburg, and had expanded further south into Friul and Aquileia. Even more importantly, he had been a crusader up in the Baltic. We've already met him in episode 131, when he rescued and then expanded the Teutonic Knights' position in Prussia and had the city of Königsberg named after him in gratitude. His friends and his foes called him the Golden King for all the splendor of his dress, his castles and his entourage. Ottokar should have been the perfect candidate, powerful and committed enough to lead the rescue of the Holy Land. So though he looks like a shoo-in there, are a few small issues here. Before Ottokar had decided to go after the imperial diadem, he had been very close to Frederick the Bitten, the Landgrave of Thuringia and Margrave of Meissen. Now, Frederick's mother had been the daughter of Emperor Frederick II, and now that all the male Hohenstaufen were dead, he, Frederick, saw himself as the true heir to the crowns of Sicily and Jerusalem, the Duchy of Swabia, and, well, all the rest. And the Ghibelline faction in Italy saw him as Frederick III, the promised emperor who would expel the Guelphs and bring back imperial order. Now, by the time old King Richard died, Ottokar was still engaged to Frederick's daughter, and there had been rumors of Frederick and Ottokar would break into northern Italy and ride all the way down to Naples. Though Ottokar had quickly ditched Frederick and all these plans to go south once he sensed that he was in with a chance to gain papal support for the crown. But there was still a whiff of imperial overreach around him. And that whiff was what the German princes felt in their nostrils too. They quite rightly worried that such a rich, powerful and ambitious prince could turn into an emperor who would curtail their rights and, shock horror, forced them to hand back all the formerly imperial lands and castles they had so recently acquired. And then a third international player registers an interest, Charles of Anjou, King of Sicily and Count of Provence. Charles is the man who had wrestled Sicily from the heirs of Frederick II and had just 5 years earlier had Conradin, the last Hohenstaufen prince, executed on the market square of Naples. He did not want an emperor to come down and contest his rule, claiming some imperial overlordship of Sicily, as had happened several times before. Charles could not stand himself as a candidate for the crown, since the blood of the teenage hero of the Ghibelline cause was still not dry on his hands. But he had a nephew, King Philip III of France, he decided to champion. Philip, son of Saint Louis and inveterate crusader, should again please the Pope. His nickname Le Hardi, the Bold, spoke to his determination to expand the royal domain, which gained Toulouse and Alençon, and to eradicate feuding in his kingdom. He was by all accounts a great medieval ruler, and he was very keen on the imperial crown. See, as France has gained in standing over the last century, its rulers positioned themselves more and more as the true heirs of Charlemagne. Why, they asked with some justification, should the imperial crown be in the gift of the Germans with their fragmented kingdom and ineffectual rulers? All good arguments, though. Again, from the papal perspective, there was some fear that a linker between Sicily and the empire was again on the cards, meaning the papacy could again be encircled by a powerful ruler, which in turn would lead to a rerun of the epic battle between Pope and Emperor that had only just been brought to a close. And then we have the homegrown princes. Frederick the Bitten was obviously out as the Hohenstaufen continuity candidate. The Wittelsbach Duke of Bavaria had his eye on the throne, but he would have to convince his brother, the Count Palatinate, to endorse him, and that was impossible. The Duke of Saxony briefly considered a candidature, but gave up quickly, being the poorest and the most remote of the electors. That was it. The Pope had said he wanted a unanimous vote. He wanted the empire united so that the urgently needed crusade could get underway. He did have a preference for Ottokar, but in the end he left the decision to the electors. Spoiler alert, the electors did not choose Ottokar, nor did they choose Philip of France, nor did they choose anyone amongst their own number. They did choose a count from the Aargau in northern Switzerland, who had become wealthy, if not rich, on the disintegration of the Hohenstaufen and the demise of the Kyburgs and the Zähringer. A man, 55 years of age, a renowned warrior, tall and manly, a name you may have heard before. Rudolf of Habsburg. Now, before we get to how they arrived at this decision, let us take a few moments and think about how European history would have panned out if they had chosen either Ottokar or Philip of France. A king and later emperor Ottokar would have shifted the center of gravity of the empire eastwards. His interest lay in Poland, Hungary, and northeast Italy. He would, in all likelihood, have regained the Hohenstaufen possessions in Franconia and maybe Swabia. Bavaria and the Palatinate would have become satellites of the Bohemian king. In other words, it would have been the Habsburg Empire just 200 years before it was actually created. And this could have been enough time to assert a more powerful central authority across the empire. It would also have given the Slavic components of the empire much more weight, whilst the three archbishops of Cologne, Trier and Mainz would have ended up in the periphery. Now, had Philip III of France gained the crown, a quite different scenario would have emerged. The French monarchy was a lot more streamlined and more focused on consolidating power and establishing a functioning royal bureaucracy. If gradually applied to the westernmost regions of the empire, France would have had more resources to rebuff the English in the Hundred Years' War. From 1303, they also dominated the papacy and, in conjunction with the Anjou in Sicily, could have dominated the wealth of Italy. The empire would thus have become again the universal empire of Charlemagne and Otto the Great, the central authority for the whole Western Europe. It might even have led to a reconsolidation of Germany, France, Burgundy, and Italy, and would have thereby sidestepped many of the nationalist wars of the 19th century. Okay, this may be pushing it a bit too far, but one fact is undeniable. Without this election, the Counts of Habsburg, instead of becoming rulers of an empire where the sun never sets, would have remained in the second division. Important princes in Swabia, and then, well, after the loss of Switzerland, they could have even faced relegations into the regionals. Which gets us to the million-dollar question. Why did they choose Rudolf von Habsburg? Usually, this is all about friends in high places, but sometimes, rarely, but sometimes, it is about just friends. And Rudolf's friends was another Frederick, Frederick the Burggraf of Nuremberg. This Frederick was not in contention for the crown, but he was seen as an honest broker, someone who had the ear of all the important people. And he convinced the electors that Rudolf, a count from the Aargau with possessions in the Alsace and the Black Forest, was, well, the perfect candidate. He was already old by the standards of the time and should therefore not last very long. He was rich, but not so rich as to be a genuine threat. He was a warrior of some renown, someone who could lead an army on crusade. He actually had already been on crusade. He had fought with the Teutonic Knights alongside Ottokar. And he had been one of the great winners of the dismemberment of the Hohenstaufen lands, which meant he was unlikely to force the other princes to disgorge their gains. He had a brace of daughters he could marry to the remaining bachelors amongst the electors, tying them to him and vice versa. He had been a supporter of the Staufer in the past, may have even been the godson of the old Emperor Frederick II, but he was also loyal to the papacy. He was basically all around the solution to all their problems. And Frederick Burggraf of Nuremberg convinced him. Ottokar II protested, but the other electors removed him from the list of electors and replaced him with the Duke of Bavaria. And so, after negotiations that had lasted 18 months, from 1272 to the 1st of October 1273, finally, a unanimous decision was arrived on. Rudolf von Habsburg was to be king. And here's the irony. Frederick Burggraf of Nuremberg, who held the stirrups for the ascent of the House of Habsburg, had been a member of the House of Hohenzollern, an ancestor to Frederick the Great and Wilhelm I, who would break the power of the Habsburgs almost exactly 600 years later. Being elected to kingship of an empire that barely exists anymore is not a straight road to world domination, though. Many things Rudolf and his descendants will still have to do to get there. And the first step on this journey was the confrontation with Ottokar II, the Golden King, who is, as the English would say, a bit miffed about the outcome of the election. But that is a story for another time. Well, for next time, to be precise. I hope you will come along again. And before I go, let me thank all the patrons and the one-time supporters who have been so generous by signing up on patreon.com/historyofthegermans and on historyofthegermans.com/support. Your help is really, really appreciated.